We start this with air guitar.
Hello.
Hi.
And welcome
to My Favorite Murder.
This is your comedy true crime podcast that you check in with weekly.
Yeah, just to see how you doing.
Just see how we doing.
Hey, how we doing?
Here's one way we're doing. Right now I have an imported Australian cookie in my hand.
Fuck yeah, you do.
A good friend of ours, insert name here later, sent us a box of Australian candy and cookies.
Yeah.
And to that person, name to be inserted later.
It's the gal who made us those candy hearts. Steven, what's her name?
Jess,
what's her?
Something by Vintage. Shit.
Fuck. Pause. She sent us a bunch of Australian candies and cookies, and we're eating, guys, from in America. I didn't know this till we went to Australia. There's this thing that they fucking have called Hundreds and Thousands. It's just sprinkles everything.
It actually, you know, it's kind of like a cookie, an Australian cookie version of a Pop-Tart.
Yes.
It's a Pop-Tart feel.
No jam.
No, nothing in the middle. It's just kind of like dry and flaky with pink and sprinkles on top.
Yeah.
But then for some reason, it's the best cookie.
Yeah.
For the love of Vintage.
Yes. We did an unboxing and she sent us a bunch of cute of her, what is it called? Crafts. And then a bunch of candy too, which is just the way to get our attention for sure.
Yeah. So we've been eating. We're here in the office. Yeah. We're at the exactly right offices right now.
That's right.
We unboxed that unboxed box was sitting in the office kitchen. So we've just been slowly all day long eating Tim Tams and Hundreds and Thousands.
You can see that unboxing video. Hey, we never plug the fan cult.
Are we embarrassed to plug the fan cult?
Are we embarrassing? Yes.
Ourselves?
We have a fan cult. If you go to myfavoritemurder.com, you can join. You get a fucking exclusive t-shirt and pen. We're now going to do it for every live show. We're going to do a 2-ticket giveaway.
Yes.
Now, but
that's
we put
very exciting
unboxing videos of like gifts people fucking send us once a week too.
Yeah. And those ticket giveaway starts at the San Diego shows for this weekend.
Right.
So if you're in the San Diego area, you belong to the fan cult or
and
you want to join
pissed
it.
That you didn't get tickets.
Get on there and you can enter to win 2 tickets to one of the 2 shows that we're doing
that's
in San Diego.
And we come out of this off stage and hug you right in the audience. I didn't tell you that, but that's part of it.
That's written in the fine print.
Yeah, Karen has to hug you.
I'll fucking dive right into that. Remember that live show? It's the first tour. When I left the stage and went and yelled at the girl in the audience.
Yes, vaguely. Was I drinking at shows then still?
I don't know. All I know is that once I was out there, I was like, oh, I should not have just walked away and left her alone.
That's right. I was like, huh.
It was because we were giving someone shit for going to the bathroom.
That's
like
right.
Not being there when we called on them.
Oh, you were going to go sit in her seat.
Yes. And only when I got to her
got
seat
back.
Did I realize what a bad plan and how I didn't really think it through.
Let's do it at every show this tour.
Guys, what we're saying is these live shows are unpredictable.
They'll be this. They'll be that.
We're out there with you. We're up here with ourselves.
We're here. We're there. We're everywhere. Do you have a thing?
Thanks for asking. I have a pressing corrections quarter. Here's what's cool about this part. Let's not paint ourselves into intellectual corners where we start doubting every goddamn fucking word we say.
Never.
Especially since we have listeners and friends out there. This person we met when we were at the Vancouver show, her name is Yukari, and she told us when we met her in the meet and greet that she translates this podcast for Japanese listeners.
Amazing.
And people who only speak Japanese, which we were like, what? How? Why?
Why?
Really?
Are there enough people?
Is this a thing?
Really?
It was really fun, exciting. She was super cool to talk to. And luckily, with all the kindness in her heart, I'm assuming, she checked in the morning after the last episode we did to let me know that I had mistermed something. It was her and like a bunch of anime dudes that were stoked.
To correct you.
They were like, I was talking about the thing that there's a Japanese term for when your iris doesn't touch the bottom lid.
Yeah.
And I said it was called seppuku.
And you know what? I went, yeah, because you said it. This just shows me what a follower I am. Not that I would have known either way, but you said it with such confidence. I was like, wow, I can't believe Karen knows that. That's so impressive. And you just like, you had it. You didn't even like pause.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And this is, thanks for pointing that out. This is the problem area. Because when I see moment, my brain collects information like that and files it away. Mm-hmm. You should see me play Jeopardy at home.
Oh my God, I bet you're amazing.
Mind blowing. But, but when we record our conversations and every single thing needs to be right, it's absolutely not.
Does it?
Well, so seppuku, the thing that I called the whites of the eyes, mm-hmm. is actually another word for harakiri, which is the way when you have an honor suicide in Japan and you run a sword through your own stomach while on your knees. And then I believe twisting. I think that's where that twisting the knife saying comes from. But that absolutely. And Yukari, please let me know how wrong I am. That could be wrong. But
no, we're just fucking, we can't stop. we're saying that we shouldn't do it. And then we just won't fucking stop.
I won't stop. The real term I should have used was sampaku.
Oh.
This is the message, the very lovely message. Hi, Karen Kilgariff. Just listen to the latest MFM. Seppuku is Japanese suicide ritual. Oh. What you meant was sanpuku, but she actually spelled out sanpuku-gan, which literally means three white eye. Because that means there's three spaces around your iris, to the right, to the left, and on the bottom, and there should only be the two.
This is the new five head.
Nice. Exactly.
This is the new, because we're
my
number.
I have a
teeny,
two head.
Teeny tiny two head.
She also said it's not good in physiognomy. Physiognomy.
Okay.
Anyway, Yukari, thank you so much for kindly pointing that out. And everybody, could we just please all start using correct terms, Japanese terms all the time?
Let's please. We're offending the Japanese public.
Damn it.
That are listening to this in Japanese. Oh, can I?
It seems like I should probably ritually commit suicide because I have shamed my ancestors by being so wrong.
Speaking of shame, can we have what will probably is the first and will probably be the only I was fucking right? Georgia told you so.
Sure.
Moment. When we wrapped last week and we had recorded, what are they called?
An episode.
And I turned to you and Steven and I said, Karen, I think you said penis instead of products. Was that it?
I don't remember.
Do you remember?
Pieces of furniture.
I swear you said penises of furniture. And you're both like, no, I didn't even hear that.
Both Stephen and I were like, yeah, we don't.
But now I've said the word penis more times than anyone on this podcast.
Required for the story.
Yeah.
Not your problem.
But then
we got tweets from people. Yep. And then Georgia was like, I fucking told you. But I honestly, of course, I didn't hear it because I'm the misspeaker. I think I know what I said. And then Stephen was just like, no.
Yeah, if you both agreed, I was like, well, then I'm wrong.
You're outnumbered.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do.
I thought it was like a Laurel and Yanny situation.
Oh, yeah.
I heard pieces of furniture.
Laurel
I heard
and big penises. Cops.
What?
Well, now we've said penis more times than necessary. So... That's the
so
last.
So I hope you've all learned your lesson.
Georgia shouldn't do that. What else?
Do you want to hear a cool email?
This is
rad. We went on at length last week talking about Lucky Luciano, the gangster, and of course the beautiful actor that played him on Boardwalk Empire.
Right.
Then we got this email. Subject line, Lucky Luciano was brought down by a rad as fuck black female prosecutor.
Yes.
Did you ever know or hear anything about
this?
No. Of course not. Guys.
They don't teach this in fucking...
They
in
don't.
Public fucking school.
This is the shit that like goes unspoken and then everyone's like... It's maddening to me. Okay. Love your podcast, you, the cats, dogs, the vents, etc.
Yay.
I was listening to your recent ep that talked about Lucky Luciano and thought you'd love to know that the three-piece suit motherfucker was brought down exclusively because of a rad-as-fuck woman. Eunice Carter was the granddaughter of slaves, a cum laude graduate of Smith College and Fordham University, and she is intensely not here for any bullshit. She was one of New York's first female African-American lawyers and one of the first prosecutors of color in the United States. She worked for Thomas Dewey, a special prosecutor in the 1930s, to take on the mob in New York City. He hired 20 lawyers, 19 white men, and Eunice Carter.
Fuck yeah.
As a team, they mostly focus on loan sharking and kidnapping and murder, but they toss Eunice the sex work stuff to cover because, you know, woman. Eunice, being sharp, the sharp tack she is, noticed that women arrested for prostitution from all over New York City were represented by the same lawyers and bail bondsmen, and those agents had relationships with Lucky. She established that the sex workers were required to kick back half their earnings to crime bosses in exchange for legal representation, and Lucky was profiting from the prostitution.
Holy shit.
She was the only assistant on Dewey's team who ever connected him with any crime and is the reason he was sent to prison.
Holy shit.
Her grandson wrote a book about her called Invisible, and I highly recommend it to every living person.
Yes, that's our new fucking book club.
Right? Yeah, let's all read Invisible. That's cool. Stay sexy and don't mess with women because they are smart as hell. Julia in Seattle.
Julia, thank you for fucking sending that.
That is, I'm so happy to know that. Yeah. And I love that. I love knowing that.
Such a good little piece of info.
Let's all get the book Invisible and give ourselves a couple weeks.
Can I listen to it?
I have to listen
to it. Okay, great.
And then let's have a convo and you guys join us
and
buying the book Invisible.
What that means is, like with Sweet Audrina, we'll never talk about it again.
No, we absolutely will. We bailed on Sweet Audrina because we were like, it was creeping us out, remember?
Yeah, we're like, oh, I was a kid and this turned me on. We should get out of here.
I think we were having shame spiral feelings around that book. And we didn't want to like shit on, you know, the author. It was like a whole thing where we just
went. It was eye-opening. Yeah. You're like, oh, that's why I'm into that porn.
Okay. Yeah. That's why I'm into attic porn.
That explains everything. Yeah.
Attic porn. That's why you trip over the word attic.
Addict. That's it?
That's it for me. Business-wise.
I don't think I have anything.
Listen, no business whatsoever.
We're about to start our fucking tour tomorrow in San Diego.
Did you say San Diego?
Yeah, my mom
used to
call it that.
Did you say San Penis? It's unbelievable because it honestly feels like the winter tour just ended 2 days ago.
It does.
And what they're calling the spring tour, which is like, it's fucking January 10th, friends.
We had like our merch company draw us up the poster or like whatever, and we approved it because we were like, it looks great. And it was all snowy and shit.
Yeah.
And then we were like, wait a second. The people who get this in May are going to be like, what the fuck?
They're going to be like, thanks for this snowdrift pines.
Yeah. Like, hold on to it till winter.
What's happening with your spring tour, guys?
Right. Way to go.
But we're very excited to be out visiting you and seeing you again. It is exciting. We complain so much.
Oh, we're great at it. And at the end of this tour, our fucking book comes out.
Yeah.
Of all things.
Yes. It's very exciting.
I'm really nervous. We've gotten some like advanced partial copies and I've been giving them to a couple trusted friends and saying, just tell me the truth, everything.
Yeah.
And then one of them Crystal didn't. I thought she read it right away and just didn't text me about it. You know, that thing of, well, I'm just going to say nothing. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Turns out she's busy and has a life and hadn't read it yet when she did.
She probably didn't like take it and sit home immediately.
Well, that's what I was hoping for.
I know. It's very, listen, this is that thing. This is that thing of like, this is why unless somebody, I don't listen to criticism from anyone unless they have put their own ass on the line and put their actual creativity out there, because it is the hardest thing to do, to make something that is of your own.
That's a really good rule.
And put it out.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, people can tell you, I hate this, I think whatever.
But it's your vulnerability that they're reading about, which is so easy to criticize it.
Well, and also, if they've never done the same, I mean, this is straight out of Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, but if they've never done the same, their opinion can't count because they don't know what it means.
That's right.
So like we wrote a double memoir where we dredge up every stupid fucking thing we've ever done.
Truly.
And try to make it entertaining.
Yeah.
And then I didn't even think about it until people started telling us, oh, I got the advance. I like it or whatever, where I was like, oh, fuck, I forgot that's public.
Yeah.
And so now we're just stuck in that feeling.
Well, that's a good point. And I gave Kat Solon, who's designed some of our awesome merch, and she also has a TV show on Adult Swim called The Shivering Truth. So she fucking puts herself out all the time.
Yes.
And she read it and said she started crying three times already. So I'm like, oh, great.
God bless her.
Yes.
God bless
her. That's all we want is for you to fucking whimper and bawl in a, into the book.
Yeah, exactly. It's, yeah, it's creepy. I think when we did it, we just, I certainly was not thinking about the actual result.
You were thinking about
result.
Deadlines.
Yes.
So you poured it all out.
Here's and then your it's homework, like, motherfucker. And then you think you're going to walk away and never look, never see it again. And then you're like, oh, this again.
Yeah.
Great.
Right. Here we go.
That was vulnerability
corner. I'm first.
Mm-hmm. You're first.
Thank God. I've only had a half a can of wine.
I'm gonna bust right into another hundreds and thousands.
Get in there, girl.
Because the big tour's coming up.
Yeah, because you know how much people love eating on microphone. This is the murder of Susan Drauskowitz.
Okay.
Great. She goes by Sue. That's what we're gonna call her.
Okay, great.
Here she is. It's 1992. Sue is 27 years old. She works for the Northwest Airlines Boston Logan International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
So Northwest Airlines used to be an airline, I'm assuming.
It was. I used to fly on it.
Did you?
Also, I believe Boston Logan Airport is pronounced Worcester. If I'm not incorrect with that.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So Sue is this lovely all-American gal. She graduates high school in Saugus, Massachusetts, fucking down home Massachusetts gal. She becomes a reserve firefighter, and then she gets a job at the airlines. And within 5 years, she works her way up from cleaning airplane cabins to becoming the first woman in the history of the company to hold the position of ramp supervisor.
Wow.
Yeah. And like me, you're like, what the fuck is a ramp supervisor? It sounds great.
Is it those ramp, like she connects the plane to the walkway?
I wrote it down.
Okay.
I wrote, what is that job? Supervise and coordinate the activities of ground crew in the loading. So she's fucking supervising everyone in the loading, unloading, securing, and staging of aircraft, cargo, or baggage.
Whoa.
And she, it also like has to do with like gravity. Like I didn't know this. You don't just fucking throw suitcases on. It's like the heavy ones go here, this goes here, or else the plane's gonna fucking crash. So she's the supervisor of all the people doing that.
Yeah. She must be great at Tetris.
Oh, shit.
She's just like, oh, hold that one there. All right, get that L-shaped one over here.
Right, the one full of chickens, put it in the back.
That's just a plain square. That's fine.
That can go anywhere. So she is the first fucking woman to hold this job.
So awesome.
Amazing. And she's also the second ever female ground service employee working for the airline ever. So she's already fucking breaking glass.
It's so funny because it's also recent. We're not talking about the 70s.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Sue obviously is super hardworking. She's like 27 when she fucking accomplishes this. She's super hardworking. She's intelligent. She has a big heart. She's got a ton of chutzpah. She's a pretty brunette, tall and slim, but feisty. She once jumped in to break up a fight between two male colleagues. So
great.
She's like,
love
not
it.
Fucking around.
No, she's fine.
So one of the perks of her job, this is just a little bit about her, was meeting famous people because they were getting on the plane. And she had an autograph book who she would have the famous people sign, which is like the most pure-hearted thing I've ever heard of in my life. Right? I used to do that, have autograph books.
Yes, because it's usually you had one as a kid.
Yeah. I totally had one.
Yeah.
Nobody signed it ever.
Well, who would?
Yeah,
in Irvine? Look, it's the mayor of Irvine.
Hey, everybody.
Then you just start getting your friends to sign it. You're like, can we just fill this thing up?
Yeah. Yes. And my dreams were crushed. So Sue's dream was to be a cartoonist, but everyone was like, it's really hard to do that. But she was obsessed with Peanuts and had even met Charles Schulz once. All-American woman, tons of ambition. And by 27 years old, already paying off. But this is called The Murder of Sue Drauskowitz, so it doesn't go well. So on September 12th, 1992, Sue's working her graveyard shift 11 p.m. to 7 fucking a.m.,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the freezing cold Boston air. Around 1 a.m., she leaves the airport to pick up sandwiches at a nearby sandwich shop for the crew. This is an Unsolved Mysteries, by the way. Have you seen
that? Oh, wow.
Yeah. She never comes back to work after she goes to get sandwiches, and no one ever reports her missing. And in fact, the really weird thing is her time card reflects that she clocked out at the end of her shift that night and clocked in the next morning.
Okay, so there's an inside element to this.
Yep, but okay. The reality is Sue was missing out of her sandwich run. Ugh. So, because of this time card forging, she's not officially reported missing for 36 hours. Mm-hmm. When her parents finally realize that she's missing, they go to the police station on the morning of September 14th. It's Monday morning, only to be told that their daughter's body had just been found.
Oh, no.
I know. And her parents were like, her mom's amazing. Sue's blue Toyota Tercel had been found early that morning, Monday morning, parked at an auto body shop in Revere, which is about 4 miles from the airport. Mm-hmm. And the shop had been closed on Sunday the day before. So when they got to work that morning, someone noticed that blood was dripping from the trunk of a car. I know. And called the police. It's so awful. When police arrived, they opened Sue's trunk and found her body inside.
In her own car.
In her own car. Mm-hmm. She had been badly beaten and then stabbed multiple times. Ugh. Awful. Obviously. Okay. So obviously her fucking, one of her coworkers or someone had fudged her time card. But why? Like, I'm sure you did that before, right? Your friend's like, I'm running late.
Never.
I mean, can you blur or bleep the... Yes, bleep the... Please.
Bleep that accusation.
Bleep the place I just mentioned you worked at.
Oh, yeah. Like people covering for you, yeah. Or going like, yeah, I don't... Can you make sure it doesn't look like I'm 10 minutes late?
Right. Or I'm leaving 3 hours early. Can you clock me out when you leave? Right. But that's like for people like working menial jobs that you don't care about. Not right. For people who've worked their way up.
And certainly not for the boss. I mean, she's right. In charge of everybody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's not... doesn't seem like a request she would make or request, you know, whatever. So, but it wasn't her mother, her parents, her mother's name is Marlene. They weren't even thinking about that question because there was no sign of robbery or rape. So the family was just led to believe that Sue was the victim of a random crime. So they didn't even consider the time card. Mm. And her mother, Marlene, lovely fucking woman, she believes all that until late 1993. So a year later. So Sue's mother is going through her daughter's old room and discovers Sue's diary.
Oh shit.
Mm-hmm. Marlene is fucking surprised to read Sue's detailed accounts of the rampant sexual harassment that she had been enduring at work leading up to her murder.
Oh no.
Marlene reads how, and of course Sue didn't want to worry her family and worry her parents about it, so she just wrote it in her diary. Her mom had no fucking clue about any of this.
Right.
Marlene reads how Sue's male coworkers and underlings had held a campaign of harassment against her. They spray painted obscene graffiti about her on coal cargo holds and employee bathrooms, and they had vandalized her car. She frequently complained with the management, or like filed complaints with the management at Northwest Airlines and her union. But of course, it's fucking 92. And even now, very little is done. Mm-hmm. When Sue continues to launch complaints, she started getting anonymous threatening phone calls in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And this is before she's promoted to ramp supervisor. The job originally went to another male employee, and it turned out that he had illegally bid on the position. So when she filed a grievance to her union about it and won, and so this guy got fucking fired from the job, the harassment, of course, got worse.
Yeah.
And to the point where Sue discovered a drawing of a coffin with her name on it scrawled inside her locker.
Wow.
Isn't this awful?
Yeah. But also, I think it's just... goes to show, people like to dismiss sexual harassment as like, oh, well, you can't hang with the boys,
right?
Or you can't this or that. But oftentimes, and I've said this to people, I read this, it was worded really well in an article I read once, but it's basically like trying to say to regular guys, you need to notice the dudes that incite this shit, because those aren't normal brains. If there's a person who's like, let's go get her, there needs to be action by the dudes that are in the group but don't feel that way.
Right.
Because they're under their own kind of peer pressure to go along and get along.
Even if it's not like, let's get her. If a guy, you know, if he remarks on her ass or something, it's like, even without her hearing, it's that I don't talk like that. And I don't, you know, that's not
how
I
live. Or just, how about shut the fuck up every once in a while.
Right.
But sometimes if those pressures or those groups are too intense, then people start going along. It's making me think about that Charlize Theron coal mining movie. It's unbelievable. It's basically, it's similar, but it's not murder. But yeah, it's just that idea of like boys, when you're in a boys club, how those boys clubs can go insane if there's a woman in the mix. Right. They go insane.
Yeah, it's really horrible. And it just, you know, another example of how being a woman is a threat to your life and to your livelihood. It's just being a woman, nothing more than that.
And also having ambition. God forbid.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Fucking breaking up the boys' club.
Yeah.
And so in her diary, Sue names names of who her harassers were. Okay.
Thank God.
I know.
Yeah.
So switching gears. It turns out that the month before Sue's murder, several Northwest baggage handlers had been subpoenaed to testify before the federal grand jury because they were investigating the theft of hundreds of credit cards that had been shipped on Northwest Airlines flights to Boston and then fucking stolen. So someone at Boston, when the credit cards got in there on the plane, had stolen those credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit cards were being used to buy jewelry and get cash advances in casinos and racetracks in Las Vegas, Atlantic City.
Was it Donald Trump? Those are all his spots.
Probably. Well, it says, this is, I didn't notice this before. It says Las Vegas, Atlantic City, and Foxwoods in Connecticut. I don't know what that is.
Foxwoods is a casino.
Is
and
it?
A lot of comics do shows there. So if you live near.
Is it like Foxwoods, Dirty Dancing? You know, like.
I have no idea. All I know is that I hear comics going like, oh, I'm going to play Foxwoods.
I'm doing Foxwoods.
And it's apparently a cool gig.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
That's where I'm vacationing this summer.
Get up there.
They ended up netting whoever stole it. Ended up netting over $7 million.
Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Wow. And that's 90s money.
That's 90s money, which now we know is worth $31 million. So the Secret Service, the FBI, and of course, you know, the fucking superheroes of the world, the U.S. Postal Inspection Service.
Yes.
Were involved in the investigation. And it turns out that some of the fucking very baggage handlers that Sue names as harassers in her diary are indicted on those stolen credit card charges.
Okay.
How does that connect? Let's find out.
Right now.
The ringleader, he's described in court as the initiator at Northwest, was a dude named Joseph. In 1989, before her murder, obviously, Sue had filed a complaint and got him fired for 6 months, which doesn't seem like a punishment.
Well, that's not being fired if he came back to the job after 6 months. He was suspended.
That's exactly right. Like, just like your mug says.
That's.
So he retaliated with some of the worst harassment against her. He's fired again when the subpoenas are handed down in the credit card theft cases in August 1992 and reportedly told people he thought, listen, all of this is alleged. Can I just blanket that now?
Oh, I thought you were saying that's what he said.
No.
Look, guys, this is alleged.
Allegedly. No, everything I'm saying about him, he hasn't been charged with any crimes.
Okay.
Well, the credit that's card
important.
Shit he has.
Yeah. That's important. But he was, the credit card stuff was real.
Yes.
Okay.
That's all real, but here we go.
Okay.
He told people he thought Sue was a snitch who ratted them out to the authorities. So he thought she was the snitch for the credit card shit.
Oh.
In reality, Sue actually had no involvement in this whole thing and had never been asked to assist the investigation. But of course, they didn't know that or didn't believe that. So over the next few years, 37 people, including 10 Northwest baggage handlers, are convicted on federal charges of participating in the stolen credit card ring. So 10 of those people that Sue was being harassed by are fucking part of this credit card ring that they think she's fucking snitching on.
Yeah.
And then gets murdered. Okay. Another baggage handler mentioned in Sue's diary is Robert, who she had a brief affair with. And after that affair ended, Robert started getting super hostile towards Sue and threatening her new boyfriend and Sue. And when the subpoenas are handed down for the credit card theft, he gets the fuck out of there and transfers to an airport out of state. And then he just gets probation because he testifies. He got a 3-year prison sentence for that credit card bullshit.
Okay.
So as for the night of Sue's murder, they're like, maybe this is connected, the authorities think. So this dude, Robert, is questioned about his whereabouts that night. And he's like, yo, I was at that out-of-state airport that I work at, working at the airport. And I had no contact, didn't talk to him at all. But years later, he's indicted on 3 counts of perjury and 2 counts of obstruction of justice after they found out that they find his time cards and phone records and prove that he's not working that night. And another point is, before she left for the sandwich run around 1 a.m., Sue had received a telephone call at work from an unidentified person who wanted to meet her, supposedly.
Uh-oh.
So, like, someone luring her out.
Right.
So, Robert is convicted of obstruction of justice for lying to a federal grand jury that was investigating Sue's death. He admitted he lied to his whereabouts the weekend of her death, and he was sentenced to 18 months in prison. And then, of course, a federal appeals court ruling in Rob's case reveals that in 1998, the investigators had named Joe as a possible suspect in Sue's murder, and evidence cited showing that he had blamed Sue for the disciplinary action against him years earlier. He had vandalized her car. All of this is allegedly vowed to get revenge against her and accused her of being a snitch in the credit card investigation.
Hmm.
So all these fucking things. But since then, there has been no further action in Sue's case.
Oh.
Yeah. It's fucking cold still. And still open. Sue's mother, Marlene, is tenacious as fuck, just like her daughter. And she's never backed down in the fight. She's like up at front and center fighting for her daughter's justice. And she says she definitely thinks somebody set her daughter up and thinks that the anonymous call the night of her murder was from someone her daughter trusted who lured her from the airport to kill her. And since Sue's murder, Marlene, every single year on the anniversary of Sue's murder, Marlene holds a vigil at Logan Airport. And you see her, she's carrying a sign with Sue's photo on it, reminding people of that this woman who worked here and was last seen here was murdered, and advertising a $250,000 reward for information leading to the killer's arrest.
Wow.
And I watched a video about it, and she says, quote, I'm a very healthy woman. She's getting older. She says, I'm a very healthy woman and I'm not going away. You're going to look over your shoulder until the day that I go, but I will get you and I will get justice for my Susan. And then, so here's a footnote. If you want to cry. Remember Sue wanted to be a cartoonist,
mm-hmm.
and had been a huge fan of Charles Schulz. He drew Snoopy especially for her that adorns her gravestone.
No.
He drew it for her to get on her gravestone.
Oh my God.
So if you look it up, you can see it because she was such a huge fan of his.
I know. That's awful.
Sorry.
But that's that. I mean, like,
I just it was on an
unsolved murder, unsolved mysteries, because people want information still to this day.
It's still fucking unsolved. It's one of those ones in the back of my mind that for the past 3 years that we've done this, I've always thought of it like, I need to do that one someday. So it's not okay. And it's kind of nice that we have this podcast where we can like call attention to these insane cases like the one we did last week of Colin Pitchfork, where it's like, how is this person spending less time in jail than the person's life who he killed? You know, killed a 15-year-old and he's getting less than that time that she was alive in jail. So it's nice to be able to call attention to these fucking insane cases where the suspects are still alive. There's still time to fucking prosecute them. There's got to be more info on them. There's got to be people now willing to talk. It's a different era.
And so that video of the mom with the sign and talking about the reward, that's still current.
As of the past like year or two. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So that's the murder of Sue Taraskowitz.
Wow.
Yeah.
I got this story from friend of the podcast, true crime reporter, Billy Jensen.
Fuck yeah.
And he reminded me of it. And then I remembered, and also we talk about Wikipedia a lot on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Please don't forget about Murderpedia.
Oh, my God.
Because Murderpedia is more dedicated, and they also need money, $5, $1, $5, and $10 at a time. Please support Murderpedia. I feel like I use them just as much.
I use them a lot.
And they do that thing where it'll just be like 7 articles in a row.
Yeah.
I love it.
There's not a ton of like this fact. It's just article after article.
Articles and chronological timelines, which helped me a lot.
Yes.
So anyway, I looked this up on Murderpedia to get the details. And one of the first things it listed on there was that this case was featured on the E! Series Curse of the Lottery. And
what?
Then I remembered
that's a thing.
Seeing it.
Holy shit.
And
with your own eyeballs.
With my eyeballs. And then I was like, oh, this is such a sad, fucked up story. I gotta tell Georgia.
I didn't know that was a show, and I don't know the story, and I'm here for it.
Okay, thank you. Your presence is required.
It is basically the whole point of this podcast.
It's the podcast.
Is that we talk to each other.
You have to pay attention to me. Yeah, I think this show, E! Curse of the Lottery, is from a little while ago.
I bet.
But the story is crazy. So basically, On November 15th, 2006, 41-year-old Abraham Shakespeare was a food delivery driver, like a truck driver. So I think it was more like for the grocery store type of food.
Yeah.
He was making $8 an hour and he had $5 in his wallet.
Oh my God.
He and his coworker, Michael Ford, were headed toward Miami. They stopped at a Townstar convenience store in Frostproof, Florida.
Sure, where we all go for summer.
For summer.
After we go to the Fox Glove.
A Fox Glove casino. Then we head down to Florida. To Frostproof.
To Frostproof.
And we get some popsicles that don't have ice on them. So the two truck, they stop the truck. They go into the Townstar convenience to buy drinks and cigarettes.
Sure.
And when Michael Ford gets out of the truck, I said they get out, but Ford gets out and he asks Shakespeare if he wants a soda. And Shakespeare says, "And don't buy me that. Get me 2 lottery tickets."
Hell
and
yeah.
Hands him that last $5 out of his wallet.
I'm just picturing him saying it in like a Shakespeare soliloquy.
Forsooth. Or something like that.
The luck of the something, you know. That's all I got.
The luck of the really wide pants.
Right.
So that week, the Florida lotto jackpot was $30 million.
Ugh.
And Abraham Shakespeare fucking won it.
All of it?
He won $30 million.
You said 300.
No, I said 30.
I heard 300.
Did I say penis I say 30?
Holy shit.
He fucking wins in Frostproof, Florida.
Can you imagine?
$30 million.
You know Vince and I play regularly.
Regularly. You can't win if you don't play.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's almost like they should use that as their quote.
It's almost like.
We play regularly. My mom has played every week since I was a kid.
My whole family plays.
Same numbers every time?
Yes, because she does a couple different systems.
Okay.
But she's always got them stuck on her refrigerator. And it's like, there's one where it's everybody's birthday.
My mom does that. It's kind of sweet. She'll do like this number, the year, and all 3 of your birthdays.
I mean, because also it's going to be so sweet if that pays off.
Yeah.
That one time where it's like, so yes. I think that's the fun of the lottery.
Yeah.
Now, the other way to look at it, which is my favorite Craig Anton joke, is the lottery is like a tax for stupid people.
But it does go actually in California. I don't know if it goes to fixing the roads.
Yeah.
Schools, I meant. Fixing the road on the way to school.
That school road that's so bumpy.
You know, that the kids all learn on.
Right.
To drive.
They learn math on. Okay. So now he's a lottery winner. Okay. Everybody thinks that that's the dream come true.
Yeah.
But as we learn in the E-series, The Curse of the Lottery, it's rarely fucking true.
See, this fake fucking HGTV show where this fucking dude takes these new lotto winners to their new home, like shows them homes to buy. I'm not explaining
this
well.
Is this real?
I swear to God. Steven, will you look up the fucking...
There's a new show called, like, You Won the Lottery, Now Here's Your New Mansion?
Yeah. Buy a mansion with all that fucking lottery winnings, it's called.
How aspirational and satisfying would it be to watch that show?
It's great.
This is...
Yep.
My lottery dream home. Look at this guy.
Say the name of the host. He's fabulous.
Oh my gosh.
He should be one of the...
Is that jacket made of gold?
It probably is. He looks like one... He should be one of the Fab Five of...
Queer Eye.
Yeah.
David Bromstad.
Love you, David.
And so he's just like, this staircase leads to another safe.
He's fabulous.
Wow. But every house is in Las Vegas.
Probably. Aww. And it's like, they won and it's a number that you couldn't buy a house for in LA.
Too low.
Okay, sorry.
No. Because see, that's the thing, is that everybody's like, there's been a couple series, I think, about winning the lottery. Because then there's some people who they do fine with it. They're probably people who have a little bit of experience with money, or at least have learned some lessons.
Smart people, you can be anonymous, too.
Exactly. But when you don't have anything your whole life, and then suddenly you get $30 million, it's very, right? It's very easy to mismanage yourself.
Yes.
And to, like I did the first time I had a large sum of money paid to me when I first moved to Los Angeles. I got a holding deal.
Your first entertainment industry job that was like stupid money jobs?
To me, it was stupid money. Now it was zero money.
Wow.
When I was like, the rent's on me, everybody. Let's do this thing.
Yeah.
Cartons of cigarettes for all my friends and fake cigarettes for my other friends. So, okay.
For your fake friends.
So, Abraham Shakespeare, the thing about him is he's a really good person.
Great.
So he immediately is like, a party at my house. He buys a new house. Okay, so he does the thing. He has the choice between the one-time lump sum cash payment of $17 million.
Take that.
Or 30 annual payments of $30 million. So $1 million a year.
Take that one.
Two or one?
Oh, I would pick, let's see, he clearly fucks up. So I'm going to say what I would pick. I would do the lump sum.
Yep, that's exactly right. Okay. Yes, he does it. Now that we've named our podcast network that, I hear myself saying it. I didn't realize I say it that much.
We do.
Okay. So he goes lump sum, 17 mil. And then here's what he buys. He moves out of his working class neighborhood in Lakeland, Florida.
Yeah, you do.
And he buys a $1.1 million house in a gated community in North Lakeland.
See, a Florida $1.1 million, and there's the income tax thing that you don't have, which is why all these professional wrestlers live there.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's an insane amount of money for a house there, right?
I'm sure. Yes. 1.1.
Yeah.
For sure. The only other things he buys are a Rolex from a pawn shop and a Nissan Altima.
Oh my God, I love him.
And then he starts lending his friend. He pays for everything. He has people at his house. He lets people stay at his house. He lends money hand over fist. He pays for people's funerals. There's one guy
just
that owed him.
Like, people are dying around him and he's just like, I got this.
I got this, you guys. Yeah, it's not a round of drinks at a bar. No.
Holy shit, there's one guy you were going to say.
But one guy owed him $1 million.
What?
Like, he lent somebody $1 million.
Uh-uh.
Yeah. So it was the kind of thing where I'm sure he had a lot of guilt about winning.
Yeah.
Or like having that money.
Didn't want to become a monster.
Yeah. Phony.
So he overdid it.
Right. So he has this house where basically it's a nonstop party and there's these people all over the place. Well, and after a while, of course, he starts confiding to like his close friends and family members that he is miserable. He was happier before he won the lottery, and that he just wants to get away.
Aww.
Yeah. So basically April of 2007.
So like a year later.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It happened at the end of 2006, November.
Holy shit.
So it's like, yeah, it's basically
That's
5 months later.
A lot of money to spend in a very short amount of time.
Yes. In 4 months later, Michael Ford, the guy that was with him the day he bought that winning lottery ticket, tells him he wants at least $1 million. But of course, Abraham Shakespeare's like, yeah, no, I'm not giving you $1 million because you were there. And he goes, fine, I'll sue you. And he takes him to court claiming that Abraham actually stole those two tickets out of Ford's wallet and that they were his tickets that were stolen. Yeah. So on October 19th, 2007, they go to court.
No.
And it takes the jury a little over an hour to rule that Abraham Shakespeare did not steal that winning ticket and that he doesn't owe Michael Ford any money.
Sure.
But the money at this point is starting to run out, as it will. Paying for funerals,
it tends
lending
to do
money,
that.
All that stuff. Yeah, it goes. You spend it and it's gone. Mm. The guy that he gave $1 million to was known only as Big Man. There's no
When I meet a guy named Big Man, I just want to give him money.
You're like, buddy, I want to bankroll you as a human being. Okay, so in October of 2008, a 40-year-old woman named Dee Dee Moore reaches out to Abraham Shakespeare. Now, Abraham Shakespeare has basically like locked himself in his mansion. He's had to kick out all these people.
Sure.
His generosity has gotten him nothing but more problems.
Uh-huh.
Well, then this woman named Dee Dee Moore shows up, says that she's writing a book about how people have been taking advantage of him as a lottery winner. So he starts telling his story.
Uh-huh.
And she must have been an amazing psychopath. Because she convinces him to let her be his financial advisor.
No.
And within 3 months, the ownership of Abraham Shakespeare's home had been transferred to a company called American Medical Professionals.
Fake.
Right? And that turns out that's Dee Dee Moore's company.
Shit.
So she basically convinces him that he won't have to pay taxes if he puts his money into an LLC, and it's called Abraham Shakespeare LLC. So it's like, it's basically, she starts a corporation for him.
Okay, but it's under her name?
Well, no. In the beginning, it's under his name.
Uh-huh.
She says, put your money here. You won't have to pay taxes. You won't have to pay child support.
Uh-oh.
You won't have to do... She's basically...
Everyone, don't try to get out of paying child support, please.
Or taxes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant taxes or child...
Well, you're...
Fuck the government. Sorry.
Yeah. You're about kids first. But all of the, it's like, especially when you're up in this amount of money, they're paying attention to every dime that you spend. And eventually she moves into his house. The title of his house is signed over to her.
Nope.
So yeah. So we're having a problem. Well, it's not signed over to her though. It's signed over to American medical professionals. Mm,
they're professionals.
Doctors everywhere. Okay, so Abraham Shakespeare is last seen in the Lakeland area in April of 2009. And later the police find that he last used his cell phone on April 6, 2009.
Shit.
But even though no one knows where he is and he disappeared and he's not at home, his family's getting texts from him saying that he's just laying low, don't worry about me. Well, they think that's weird because Abraham never learned to read or write. He dropped out of school like in junior high. And so they're like, maybe he's getting someone to do it. Like, they're just like,
what? He had never texted before. So then suddenly they're like,
yeah, they're just kind of like, something's off because he just is gone.
I was thinking about how you should go out more because if someone kills you and starts writing, hey, I'm just going to stay home tonight, text to people, they'll believe it.
Oh, yeah.
They won't be like,
thanks for laying that out in black and white.
Sorry.
No, I've actually made that joke before that in every true crime show, they go, I knew something was wrong because that night she didn't call me back.
I could tell, like, she was home and she didn't answer the door.
It's so unlike her where I'm like, oh my God, I can just picture my dad going, yeah, I simply don't hear from her for weeks at a time. I text her. She doesn't respond. I'm super funny. She won't say anything to me. She can't explain her whereabouts.
So we didn't know anything was amiss.
And I'm laying in a ditch like, God damn it.
I should have been an extrovert.
Why am I a hermit? I deserve what I'm getting. Okay, so that November, Abraham's cousin files a missing persons report because he's like, okay, it's been long enough. He would have either come back, connected, made an actual phone call or whatever. He explained to the police they were hoping that he had gone to the Caribbean because he had been saying he wanted to do that basically since he won the money.
Yeah, he's like, fuck, he wanted to fuck off.
Yeah. And because they were getting those texts, it was almost that thing of like, well, this is weird, but at the same time, at least we're hearing from him.
Yeah.
So best case scenario. But then his cousin said they were just like, no, something's wrong.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So on November 12th, 2009, detectives go interview Dee Dee Moore because they find that she's right in the center of all of his business. Mm-mm. Everything's signed over to her. She's living in his house. They're like, all right, we're going to have a chat with you. She explains to them that she started the corporate account for him, and that she was paying him in cash out of that account, basically, because she was better at business and she was, you know, going to be the one. She was this financial manager.
Look, I have a company that has the name professional in it.
Right?
That's how you can tell.
It's me, the one who should be in charge of your money of the name of a thing I made up. She denies having anything to do with his disappearance, but she explains she took over his assets, which at the time were like $3.5 million plus the mansion, plus all the money people owed him, which counted because it was their plan of getting people away from him, asking him for money.
Right. He's like, I don't even have control over it.
Yeah. She's old. I put Dee Dee in charge. I met her 3 months ago. She also claimed that she set things up the way she did because Shakespeare didn't want to pay child support and because he had a drug problem and he would just use the money for drugs. So that's why she took all of his stuff and didn't pay him. All the money goes into that account and then doesn't go back out.
Yay.
She sets up Abraham Shakespeare LLC and then takes his name off and it's her account now.
Fuck.
So
it's
that. And then when the cops are like, so anyway, let's walk this in. And then she's like, yeah, no, that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
He wanted me to have everything.
That leopard print couch I bought that's over there.
He supported me in all of my choices. Mm. So this is where, around this time, is where our friends over at Web Sleuths come into the mix.
You guys?
And this is the Billy Jensen element because he's all about that.
With all the twists and turns, I forgot about Billy even. Oh my God.
So on the Web Sleuths board, somebody posts a news article about a missing Florida man who named Abraham Shakespeare, who had won $30 million in the lottery, blew through most of the money, and now had disappeared. So the citizen detectives, of course, dig in. Mm-hmm. And they see that he's hired Dee Dee Moore as the financial advisor. So then they start going into her financial and property records and posting them on the site. noting that her bank account reflects that she has come into a lot of money recently.
How do you find that?
This is, it's that shit they do that they're so good at.
Oh,
like, this is their jam.
I hope they only use their powers for good and not evil. Just want to put that out there.
Yeah, please, let's everybody stay above board.
Stay off the dark web.
Come on.
Nothing good that can come out of it.
Please. You don't need to buy that arm.
You don't need more photos of feet.
You can get those anywhere.
Go to wikifeet.com.
So gross.
Google my name in there.
Okay, so February 21st, 2009, they find Dee Dee Moore has bought a 2008 Corvette for her boyfriend for $70,000.
Jesus.
She paid with a cashier's check from her American Medical Professionals business account.
It's a write-off.
Yeah, right. A month later... It's a tax break. A month later, she buys a 2009 Hummer for $90,000.
Holy, a Hummer's more than a Corvette?
Yeah, girl,
I don't know anything about
20
cars.
Grand more.
Once you get over $2,000, that's the most I've ever paid for a car, like, at once is $1,600.
I think because Hummers are like, you can shoot an AK-47 into the side of them and be fine.
They're talking to N-dazers who are like, we need to keep safe.
Mad Max shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in a Corvette, you're like, oh, the sunroof's off. I've been killed. Okay. So this is amazing. So she buys a house. It's all this stuff. And they're just like, well, this is interesting because here she is and here's all her shit.
Uh-huh.
And his money's gone. So once all these posts start going up, somebody logs onto Web Sleuth and begins to defend Dee Dee Moore, offering up even more incriminating evidence against her as they're trying to defend her.
No.
So, of course, our citizen detectives track the IP address of the defender down. And lo and behold, it's Dee Dee Moore.
It's so stupid what people think that people can't get away. Like, you can't get away with this shit, dude.
No.
Don't fucking try.
Don't try. It's so dumb. And also, it's that thing of, which I think, especially in the internet age, we find more and more, is people, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
So you're going on to Web Sleuth like, I got this.
I changed my IP address. Well, they can see who bought that IP address, and it still leads back to you.
Dee Dee, unless you work at MIT in the computer lab, I wouldn't go up against the Web Sleuth.
Let's not.
Okay, so the citizen detectives send all of this to the police, obviously. A couple days after Christmas of this year.
This year?
No, sorry, of that year.
Great.
Big difference.
Oh.
Of this year, I was talking about 10 minutes ago.
Remember when you told the whole story, that current story?
Yes, that was 12 years old. I'll never forget it. The bags of leaves in the living room. I was like, yeah, we were both in the city, but I'm the one that found this brand new breaking story. And they're like, Karen, we hate to inform you. You fucking idiot. Okay. A couple days after Christmas, 2009.
Got it.
Dee Dee Moore takes Abraham Shakespeare's mother, Elizabeth Walker, out to eat. This is fuck devious shit.
His mommy?
Yes, his mommy. And during the meal, she receives a phone call from someone.
No.
Who says, it's me, Abraham Shakespeare, just calling to say I'm fine. So then she's like, oh, he called me. Everything's okay. The next day, the detectives interview Abraham Shakespeare's friend, Gregory Smith, who, it turned out, was already an informant.
No.
Yeah. I mean, he had a record and he was already kind of there.
Yeah.
And he, they basically get out of him that he was paid by Dee Dee Moore to impersonate Abraham and call his mother to say he's fine. So since he's already an informant, they're like, all right, you did that. You won't get in trouble if you now wear a wire and we need to get this woman and we need to get some good information from her.
Totally.
And he's like, I want to help. He was my friend. He loaned.
Was this guy big man?
Gregory Smith. He wasn't big man, but he did loan him $60,000.
Holy shit.
So he said, like, I'd been a part of it, but I realized I needed to do the right thing and help. Yeah. So, so basically, they say, you need to get close to her and get good information. And thank God they did, because a month later, Dee Dee Moore asks Gregory Smith if he knows anyone who'd admit to law enforcement they were responsible for killing Abraham Shakespeare for money. And Gregory Smith's like, yeah, I do. Let me get back to you with some
hundreds
names.
Hundreds and hundreds of people. Hundreds and thousands of people.
Hundreds and thousands. Because she was like, is there somebody that's like a prisoner that'll just do this?
Right. I'll take the fall. I'll give their family money.
Yeah.
You know,
free and clear.
Right.
So On January 21st, 2010, an officer named Mike Smith goes undercover as a guy who will admit to the murder for money.
Fun.
AKA the dumbest man in the world.
Not the actual officer. That's someone who would do that.
Exactly.
You're not calling Mike.
I'm not calling Officer Mike Smith of the Lake Wales, Florida Police Department the dumbest man in the world. No. Never would I do that.
You're calling someone who would, whatever.
Yes.
We get it.
Do we get it?
Don't we?
So, so Dee Dee agrees to pay him $50,000 to confess to law enforcement that he is responsible. And Mike Smith, undercover, tells Dee Dee, I'll do this if you just tell me where you put his body.
Yeah.
At that moment that she didn't go, huh?
Yeah.
Why do you need to know that as a prisoner?
I wonder. Well, it's that, it's the cocky confidence of I'll never get caught. So yes. I'm never suspicious.
Yeah.
Because I'm so fucking cocky.
I'm masterminding this.
Yeah.
I'm a true psychopath.
I'm not going to get caught for this shit. I'm a mastermind.
I'm the smartest person on the planet.
Look.
So on January 25th, Dee Dee meets back up with Gregory Smith, who's working with undercover cop Mike Smith. Mm-hmm. And she shows him the concrete slab in the backyard of her ex-boyfriend's house. Mm. And she says he's buried underneath there.
Oh, shit.
Uh-huh. She also gives Gregory Smith the .38 Smith & Wesson, which she used to kill him.
She did it?
Yeah. Oh, I guess spoiler alert. So immediately the cops go to that location. They excavate that concrete slab and they find Abraham Shakespeare. The body of Abraham Shakespeare is buried underneath his concrete slab. He's been shot twice.
Fucking concrete slabs, man.
It's such a dumb idea. So what happens is they get her, Dee Dee Moore's ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
They interview him and he says that Dee Dee called him during the first 2 weeks of April asking to dig a hole in the yard.
As you do.
As one would. Because she needs to bury concrete and trash in it.
Uh-huh.
He digs the hole and he leaves. She calls
him.
He had
no idea. He had no idea. There's gonna be a body in it.
She calls him back 2 hours later to fill the hole back in. And he tells police because it was nighttime, he didn't see what was in it. So he just filled it in and walked away at the end.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Sounds on the level.
So, on February 2nd, 2010, Dee Dee Moore is arrested and the judge sets her bond at $1 million. And then she's charged with first degree murder. She pleads not guilty. And December 10th, 2012 is when the trial starts. And at the beginning of the trial, the judge, Emmett Battles.
Oh, so my classic. God. Amazing.
Can you see him? To me, he looks like Colonel Sanders.
To me, he's a Civil War reenactor.
Yes.
For sure.
So we got mutton chops on all sides of the head.
During the week, it's like having a mullet. It's like, and you're in a business suit.
Yeah.
But you have mutton chops and you're, I don't know where I'm going with this. It's just something.
You were seeing a vision in your head of Emmett Battles and you were talking through it. I like it. That he tells the jury, you can convict her on a lesser charge.
Don't do it.
So they start the trial. Dee Dee's attorney tells the jury that she was just trying to help protect Abraham Shakespeare and his assets from a pending child support case. When in the middle of all that, he was killed by drug dealers who no one's looking for because they're attacking her.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, detectives had found CCTV footage of her buying plastic sheeting and duct tape.
I don't care what you're actually doing that's on the level. Don't ever buy that shit.
No.
You know?
Leave your duffel bags at home.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all of it, you certainly can't do it in combination.
No,
zip ties, duct tape. Don't.
You know we have zip ties all over the house, and it's making me really uncomfortable because we use them for the live show banner.
Oh, I'm probably gonna have to call the cops.
I wish you would. I don't know why anyone hasn't yet.
Quickly. Okay, so that's a bunch of bullshit. Everyone knows it immediately. Then they're just like, here's her doing all this crazy shit. And also, here's a detailed record of the finances and where it went and how it went there. And are you stupid?
And thanks, Web Sleuths.
At one point, this is just a side fun fact. At one point, Dee Dee Moore is briefly banned from the courtroom over concerns that she may have threatened jurors.
Oh, dear.
Dee Dee.
Dee Dee, don't double down at this point, please.
She didn't give a shit. But she came back a short time later for closing.
She's like, sorry.
Guys, I won't kill your family.
Pinky swear.
The jury deliberates for 3 hours before Dee Dee Moore is found guilty of first-degree murder. She's sentenced to mandatory life without parole.
Yes.
That's that verdict you're always looking for. Uh-huh. And following the verdict, the judge calls Dee Dee, quote, the most manipulative person he's ever seen. Mm. And he describes her as, quote, cold, calculating, and cruel.
Wow.
That is the story of the murder of Abraham Shakespeare. And watch that curse of the lottery, because it actually goes into much more about how giving and kind he was and how,
except for to his kids for child support.
Well, we don't know, do we? We don't know the details of it, because actually $5,000 was paid to Abraham's ex-wife in the name of his child.
Okay.
So
I'm not judging. You're about to spill coffee on Stephen's equipment.
Let's not take what Dee Dee tried to say. I actually also just love the name Dee Dee as a villain from Florida.
Well, it's fucking Dee Dee Blanchard too.
That's right.
Dee Dee's are bad news, which is one of Dottie's nicknames.
Yeah.
She's a good girl.
She does her best.
She does. tries very hard. Twists and turns.
Right?
That goes to show you. Take the yearly payout.
Take that yearly payout and make your own corporation. Mm-hmm.
Disappear.
I love also the idea of just naming your corporation like Karen Kilgariff LLC. And just like, you can make up anything.
Yeah. Or like, just put the word professional in it.
Just how about professional?
Professional professionals.
Inc. Oh, that's good.
Why don't we name our podcast network Professional Professionals?
We'll call some people.
Fuck. We'll change it. Shit, man. Twists and turns.
Right?
That was a good one.
What's your fucking hooray for this week?
Hundreds and thousands.
Australian cookies of all kinds.
Let me think. Actually, let me think. You have one?
Yeah. You want me to do mine?
I would love you to do yours.
Well, I have two, but they're both the media ones that we like. First of all, my friend told me to listen to a podcast. It's from Wondery and it's called Gladiator.
Oh,
and
I've been listening to that.
Are you listening to it?
I am.
Is it because I told you to?
No.
God damn it. it's called Gladiator and it's about Aaron Hernandez, who was one of the New England Patriots, and he ended up going to jail for murder. Well, just listen to it because I was just going to spoil the hell out of it, but it's a really, really beautifully done podcast at Wondery by a team of people. And here's the thing, and maybe newspapers are onto this already, but if they're not, please tell them. This is the way that newspapers can come back, because like all those, like from the Australian, Teacher's Pet series.
That's right.
Now you've got this one that's out of the Boston Globe.
There's the Bear Brook podcast that I love. That's is from a newspaper too.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
This one is the Boston Globe, the Spotlight Department, which is the one that did the big expose on the molesting priests.
Oh, I listened to there's a podcast about that. Nope. That's something different. Never mind.
So basically it's the Spotlight Department, where it's the investigative department, but now they're fucking making podcasts. So
Can we get Skip Hollandsworth on this fucking beat, man? Or Skip Hollandsworth from Texas Monthly?
Maybe. But my thing is that kind of investigative journalism, it transfers directly to podcasting.
Totally.
It's beautiful. And the person that hosted, I'm sorry, I don't know his name offhand, but he is a reporter from the Boston Globe that is basically hosting his own research.
So
and
good.
It's a beautifully done thing. There's a whole team of people. It's great.
Listen, there are think pieces everywhere.
Right? And then the other one is just, it was recommended to me on Twitter about 2 weeks ago. It's a Netflix series called Dairy Girls.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about a group of high school girls in Belfast in the 90s. And it's fucking hilarious and beautifully done. And I love it so much. And please watch it if you're in the mood for something fun.
Okay. I'm going to do it.
Do it.
Let's see. Oh, so you know how I told you back when we recorded in December about the hashtag that I had gotten from Jen Gotch, that I stole her idea of showing your meds in your hand.
Yeah.
And then hashtag it. Someone suggested my favorite meds and I was like, this is great. And then people started.
That's stolen actually.
From us?
You're like, no, you're taking Jen Gotch's thing and like, now it's my thing. Well, my favorite meds.
she put the meds in and I was like, that's a great idea. And I did it. And I said, I got it from her. And then let's hashtag it and show our fucking meds off. And so people have been doing that. And I've been reading all these beautiful like stories of becoming, you know, realizing you need help and all this stuff. And it made me realize that my meds aren't working the way, like reading all these people, like their accounts of how much it's helped them, like, yeah, made me realize my shit's not helping me.
Yeah.
So I went back to my psychiatrist and I'm changing medications. It's going to take months. It's like a fucking long process. But I'm doing that. And it's so funny that I was like, I copied Jen and was like, this is a thing. And then I'm like, oh, I got something out of it too.
Yeah. And that's a big thing to get out of it.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. Everyone was like, my life has changed. I do this, I do that. And I'm like, I still feel pretty fucking shitty.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just like, that's what I get. And it's not.
Well, and also I think so much has been going on in your life,
yeah,
that this, it's normal to feel stressed. It's normal to feel scared. It's normal to be overwhelmed.
Right.
That then you can't, you don't have a normal stasis or whatever they would call that anymore.
Yeah.
And how can you tell?
The thing of like, well, my baseline of everything is fine is not other people's baselines of everything is good. So it's like, yes, you're doing much better and you feel better than you wouldn't if you wouldn't be on meds, but that doesn't mean that that's where you need to settle.
Yes.
You know,
it's good like
you can strive for more than that. So I'm striving for Zoloft to make me better than Effexor.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Are you going to get the zaps if you go off Effexor?
That's why it's taking a very long time to do it.
Because you have to slowly.
So yeah. Slowly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, good though.
Yeah.
Great.
Fuck it.
Great. And also great that something like that, you don't have to feel weird about any of this shit anymore.
Never.
There's no need.
It's so funny that I didn't realize how many people were ashamed of it or didn't talk about it, or it's like so natural to me,
yes,
that I didn't even think to talk about it.
Right.
Because it's normal.
Yeah, because who cares?
Who gives a shit? Make fucking strive for your best.
And also I remember one time saying something out loud about my therapist at my dad's house, and my cousin who was there was like, what? And the reaction he had was so weird. And instead of like being offended or ashamed, mm-hmm, or anything, I just remember sitting there going, oh no.
You poor thing.
Well, like it's not 1945.
No.
Like you don't, as scary as the idea of it might be to,
yeah,
you, don't negate people or
totally,
like, don't try to make people feel bad who are trying to make themselves feel better.
Shaming you. I just in the beginning felt weird about being like, oh, well, mine and Vince's therapist, because it to me, you know, in the beginning it was like, oh, I'm telling people that we have a bad relationship, which is the opposite. We're going so that we have a better relationship.
Right.
And starting from a good point instead of starting from the fucking bottom.
Everybody has to learn how to communicate.
Yeah.
That's just how it is.
Oh my God. Looking back at how we communicated, which was just to not make the other person feel bad. So we never said what we wanted
because
we just don't want to hurt each other.
Ew.
It just, yeah, it didn't work. So
that's horrible.
Yeah. So, yeah, now I don't give a shit. I say it all the time. Like our therapist, just, yes, to normalize it.
Well, and also I think the standards by which people judge things are so stupid. Like what people post on Facebook about their family, which is like,
yeah,
that there's no bigger red flag than when people are consistently like, we're having the best and we love each other. Where it's, oy, like, why are you doing that? Where, yeah, it's like, that doesn't make it happen.
We know your baby just had an explosive diarrhea out of its diaper. That's the fucking reality.
The reality is half the time you hate the person that you're married to.
Oh no.
Sorry. I mean, like the reality is life is hard.
Yeah.
You fuck up. They fuck up and then you fix it. It's all about fixing it and moving on and getting stronger because of the fix.
Totally. Totally.
I didn't make that up.
That's why you and I go to therapy together.
Exactly. No, seriously, because we as much as we get along, we are absolutely opposite people.
Mm-hmm.
And we,
our therapist says we are the perfect triggers for each other.
Yeah. We absolutely are.
Yeah.
And there are things that like, if we didn't have a person, it's not even like learning to go like, you need to be nicer, you need, yeah, to do this. It's like the bigger lesson of your intent is not the same thing as the impact what you do has. And that lesson is humongous.
And like, your reaction is coming from a place of fight or flight, not from conversation or from working shit out
or the present.
Because it's triggering.
Yes. If you're triggered, you're in like 20 years ago. Totally. You're doing a totally different thing. And you need help. We all need help with relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fucking hard, man.
I mean... I'm the expert because I'm divorced. So please listen to everything I say.
Did you guys go to therapy ever together?
I can't talk about it.
Great. She signed the non-disclosure agreement. She got $5,000 in child support and peace the fuck out of it.
And he's buried in my backyard. Stop it.
I always wonder what that concrete slab was.
No, that's decorative.
You told me you were putting your trash in there and it came over one night and filled it with concrete.
This is my dark concrete slab that I have concrete buried underneath.
I couldn't see anything.
Yeah, because I only invite people over in the dark.
Damn it. I feel had.
Listen, I understand.
We'll talk about it in therapy.
So I feel really angry at Georgia because
Karen
she feels
made
sad.
Me, bury a body, and I just feel like it's triggering.
But was it a body or was it concrete?
I'll never know.
Dump your concrete under this concrete slab is what Dee Dee tried to tell.
Honey,
people.
Please.
This is where I dump my concrete, lady.
Thanks for listening. Thanks to Stephen Ray Morris for so many edits at fucking 11 o'clock at night, the night before we're posting.
Stephen.
Thank you.
Stephen, do you know we love you?
We love you, Stephen. I think we need to start thanking Stephen because people do at the end of podcasts. This has been brought to like edited by so-and-so and brought to you by blah, 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 and music by Karen Kilgariff.
Okay, do it, do it.
I just did it. Oh. Music by Karen Kilgariff. Special thanks to Stephen Ray Morris for the fucking editing and shit.
For the amount of editing that doesn't even make sense or like... Can you please put that back together? And we've just had to do some fixes.
Look, listen.
Stay sexy.
And don't get murdered.
Goodbye!
Elvis, you want a cookie?
That was great.